Last summer, many wild animals suffered because of a lack of water. This year, nests have been washed out and wild babies have been separated from their mothers through floods and storms. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. We're going to talk about floods, fire, and wildlife. We'll find out how natural disasters affect wildlife, talk about the boom and bust cycles that many populations go through, and find out how population management by humans works. We're also in the midst of our summer membership drive. Become a member at 800-971-8815 or iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We have all been affected by flooding this spring. And by all of us, I'm including Iowa's wildlife as well. This hour, we're going to talk about floods, fire, and wildlife. And wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And I think before we start talking about floods, I think we should do a little biology 201 and talk about population dynamics, because, of course, you know, we have a lot of different things in the environment that affect animal populations, and the populations are changing all the time.
Yeah, and that's the thing that, we get concerned about individual animals. I think that's a natural sort of human response to seeing suffering in anything, including ourselves. So we are concerned about the individuals. But when we think of it on a larger basis, on a population basis, populations are very rarely steady all the time. They go up and down from year to year, from season to season. Things live and die just as we do. And the populations are impacted then by a variety of things, including weather and long-term climate change and habitat and lots of things. So there are things that impact populations on a rather large scale, and so the populations will increase suddenly and then maybe sometimes just as suddenly decrease. We see those populations fluctuations as we go away from the equator towards the poles. You get these really dramatic population fluctuations the closer you get to the poles. In part, that's because the system is essentially simpler. The food webs aren't as complex. There aren't as many different things that you can potentially eat or be eaten by in as you get closer to the poles. So the population fluctuations are much greater. I think many of our listeners have heard about the lemming declines, and we see evidence of that. Lemmings are little small mouse-like critters that live in the tundra, and their populations will explode some years, and then just as suddenly they will decrease 3 or 4 years later in a dramatic way. Snowshoe hares, the 10-year cycle of the snowshoe hares was another one. I studied those when I was a master's student at Wisconsin. We were looking at snowshoe hares in northern Alberta and their population fluctuations. And they go from, one hare per 10 acres at a low to 10 hares per acre. So a couple of orders of magnitude difference in population. It's amazing difference. And that's just in a matter of a couple of years. Well, how is it that populations and why is it that populations undergo such fluctuations? Well, it turns out it's a combination of things. It is, in fact, in the case of snowshoe hares, it's resource-based. They basically breed so much and have so many of them around that they don't survive because of low food supplies. They overeat or overbreed what they have available to eat, and over a couple of winters they will decline in population very, very dramatically.
So, you know, I remember I probably saw some of your research when I was in college taking my biology classes.
Sure.
And I remember looking at those cycles, and What is the benefit to a species to have a population explosion that's so big that the population can't be supported?
Yeah, I'm not sure that there is necessarily any benefit to the species. It benefits us by knowing that, in fact, under natural conditions, probably for millennia, some populations, particularly those close to the poles or boreal forest, farther north or farther south, undergo these dramatic changes and in fact can outbreed their food supply. I think that's an important piece of information for us to kind of tuck away and go, I wonder if that applies to us as well. So does it benefit the species? Not necessarily, although if they undergo these declines, they also have ways of recovering rather quickly as well. In the case of snowshoe hares and of lemmings, they may go from they go from not having enough food to supply their population to having way too much food, and so they're very successful, they're very healthy, and instead of maybe one or two litters a summer, they'll have three or four, and they'll have larger litters as well. So they very quickly recover and do very well. The other thing that impacts our populations, though, are the predators, are the other species that are there. When hares and lemmings are very abundant, other species do extremely well. Example is a snowy owl that we saw in Iowa, not this past winter, but the year before. We saw lots and lots of snowy owls. Well, why did that happen? Well, snowy owls are able to respond very quickly to abundant food supplies, and they will double or triple the number of young that they have in a given brood if the food supply is enough. And so they respond very, very quickly, and then the lemming population apparently dropped. All of a sudden, the snowy owls in the fall of last year or two years ago. We're confronted with a situation where, wow, we don't have much food around. And so a lot of the young came farther south. And that's where we see these what are called eruptions of snowy owl populations in Iowa as they come south due to the lemming cycles. Same thing is true with lynx across Canada, actually across not just the U.S., but across Europe as well, Northern Europe and Russia. There is a cycle of predators happens as well, so that when hares are abundant, the lynx population definitely prospers and has more lynx around. And then as the hare population declines, the predators are peaking in terms of their numbers, and they further depress the hare population. And then there's not enough food for them, so they die off, and the cycle starts all over again. It's really an interesting sort of intricate balance, if you will, balancing act, I would say. When we say balance, it sounds like it's static, and it's really not. It's an act. It's an ongoing
more like
system.
Walking a tightrope.
Yeah, it is, exactly. Exactly.
So that invites a question, though. You're talking about animals that are in an environment where they're not necessarily impacted very much by humans.
Right.
Now, of course, in Iowa, we have removed most of the predators in the state. So how do the population dynamics change in an area that is altered by humans?
Well, first of all, we're in a temperate zone, and so the food webs are more complex. And populations tend not to fluctuate quite as dramatically as they do farther north. And you get near the equator, and in tropical systems, they are very complex, and so the populations don't fluctuate very much at all. They do some, but certainly from year to year or area to area. But when you're in the temperate zone, which is where the vast majority of people live across the world, and certainly in the U.S., it's certainly the case, we have definitely altered what happens to other species. First of all, by limiting the habitat. And by changing what is available. Look at what's happened in Iowa as an example. When European ancestors first came to this country, or came to this country, meaning Iowa, this land in Iowa in the 1830s and 1840s, and began to alter the landscape, some species did very well with those alterations. Things like prairie chickens actually increased for a while in numbers, even though they were being exploited by those ancestors for food and for commerce. They were actually sold and by the train load, went back east to restaurants on the East Coast. Despite that, their populations actually went up because they had small grains and pastures that suited them. But then the exploitation became far too much, and their populations declined to the point where they are worse than they are today. Even we don't have many prairie chickens in the state. We have sort of a small experimental population in the south central region of the state, but we don't have the thousands and hundreds of thousands that that we once had. Because we so dramatically altered that landscape, we went from a place that was 85% prairie to what today is a tiny percentage of that. Of the original prairie, there's 0.1%, 0.1% of the Iowa landscape is true native remnant prairie. Now, we've reconstructed some in places like Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, where we did a program a few years ago, and other places around the state, including some of our roadsides, we're reconstructing prairie. But it's not the same. These are sort of small pieces compared to the state.
And they're not connected.
No, that's right. They're either they're not connected or they're connected only linearly by roadside prairies, for example, right. Very narrow strips. But that kind of dramatic change, that means there's a tremendous change in habitat as well for the other species that occupy the state with us.
Well, let's talk about floods, because obviously these populations are changing. These food webs are intricate. So there are always things going on. But then we come along and have the wettest spring on record in Iowa.
It's been a remarkable year. And you compare it to last year. I mean, we go, as you mentioned in your introduction, we go from severe drought over very much of the state to floods all over. I mean, this is a tough to adapt to. But critters, in general, many at least, are very resilient and are able to respond to the conditions pretty rapidly. Certainly, you get severe storms, you get tornadoes, just as happens to human beings. Their homes get destroyed. Individuals die. Populations may be on a local basis certainly affected. But they, just like us, they kind of pick up and go on with their lives as best they can. And they may lose for 1 year the ability in a population in a given area may lose its ability to recover, to have, a lot of young that year. But if you look at the whole population as a state of a whole or even the region as a whole, sometimes they're not impacted as much by individual storms. Now, the widespread flooding we had this year does give us a lot of cause for concern. Very much of the habitat in Iowa is right, particularly the woodland habitat, is right along our rivers. And with so many of those rivers out of their banks, impacting the habitat that was there on a very, very widespread basis, not a single river system, but multiple river systems across the state, that certainly gives us a cause for concern because flooding. Let's be frank about it. Flooding impacts individuals and populations in an area. There are some of the larger ones can like deer can or foxes or coyotes can swim, but just like humans, they can get caught up in really swollen waters and drown.
Right. Well, and it all happened at a time of year where there were a lot of young.
You bet.
And a fawn can't necessarily go through the floodwaters like its mother can,
yeah,
for example.
Exactly right.
And
yeah.
And I have to say, just anecdotally speaking, mm-hmm. you talk about people being concerned about individuals, and since I'm related to a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, there have been a lot of fawns being brought in.
Oh,
they got
that,
separated
yeah.
from their mothers this year. A lot of baby raccoons, a lot of songbirds. But I would guess that the populations that have been most impacted are not necessarily the ones that we'll see. There are a lot of nests that have probably been totally washed out.
Yeah, there are a lot of birds that build nests on the ground. And we know, for example, of pheasant and quail, but they're not the only ones. There are lots of other birds that build their nests on the ground, too, things like oven birds and turkeys and that. And certainly many of those nests got flooded. There are some that are capable of re-nesting. Pheasants, quail, and some songbirds will re-nest. But many of them, they get one chance at it. And particularly if they're neotropical, if they migrate clear to South America, they get one chance when they come back.
We'll continue our conversation in a few minutes. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking this hour with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about floods, fire, and wildlife, population dynamics, and how natural disasters affect wildlife. You're also welcome to join our conversation when we come back at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, here today with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's an environmental interpretive and wildlife consultant based in Ames. And this hour, we're talking about floods, fire, and wildlife. We're also talking about population dynamics and how natural disasters affect those dynamics. And Jim, before the break, we were talking about the floods and how that affects a lot of nests that were built on the ground or near waterways. Do you think that we'll be able to see a visible difference next year in the size of certain populations?
Certainly we will. In some populations, we may see in particular areas along those rivers that they may be impacted. It's very difficult for humans, for us, even for those of us who are accustomed to looking at wildlife populations, it's very difficult sometimes to tell exactly what the numbers are. Now, we all sort of have this feel, I'm not seeing as many deer on the roads at night, so the population must be down. Well, maybe.
You're lucky.
Yeah, that's right. Or I'm not seeing as many. I drive to work every morning along a certain route every morning, and I know at certain times of the year the pheasants are going to be out on the side of the road. And, I'm not seeing as many pheasant broods as I used to see or I did see last year. Maybe that's true, and maybe it has to do with habitat changes. So it's very, very difficult to tell sometimes what the exact effects are of any given weather event in an area. The problem becomes one, something that you mentioned earlier, Charity, and that is that we have impacted the landscape to such an extent. We are the most altered state in the union, if you will, with human habitat. Some species that do well with the changes to that landscape are species that are most like us. Things like skunks and raccoons and to some extent foxes and deer. They seem to be able to adapt pretty easily to the changes we brought. Red-winged blackbirds, same sort of thing. They've adapted very, very easily or relatively easily, and their populations haven't suffered as much as a number of others. When you have many species, though, are not so adaptable, and those are the ones that are already either uncommon or having significant declines in their populations. We think about a lot of grassland birds, for example, that we know the changes in habitat availability and nesting area availability have definitely, on a continental basis, impacted populations of a number of those birds, everything from meadowlarks and bobolinks, a lot of grassland nesting birds are in real trouble. And that has been due to habitat change. Now, you might think that, well, gee whiz, our predecessors altered the landscape as well, too, meaning Native Americans. And certainly they did. They used fire a lot, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But there was a large landscape of prairie then. Now, when there's not much, species can't simply go elsewhere when those elsewheres have all been altered in another significant way by human populations. So there's a concern, certainly, sort of on a large basis or a regional and even a national basis for a number of species.
Mark from Des Moines has some anecdotal evidence of a population explosion for us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you? And thanks for taking my call.
What have you seen?
Well, what I'm seeing is I used to just see a few. I live right in the middle of Des Moines near Drake University, mm-hmm. So it's a very urban setting.
Sure.
And I used to see just a few rabbits a year in my yard, and now I'm seeing four or five a day.
Right.
And in fact, I have one rabbit that's just nesting in front of my house.
Sure.
I see him there every morning in the same spot. And I wanted to ask you if you have seen anything about rabbit populations.
Well, rabbit populations are one of those that undergo very rapid year-to-year fluctuations, a lot depends on weather, and a lot depends on predators. I mentioned hare populations earlier. Well, the same is true of our cottontail rabbits that are common across the state in Iowa. If there aren't many predators around, lots more of their young survive. They can have 3 and 4 litters a year, and if food is not a significant factor during the summer months, it's not. If they come into the spring, if the females come into the spring in a very good body condition, they will have large litters and they'll have, as I say, 3 or 4. So you can imagine that population of rabbits in an area, if you haven't got a lot of predators around, they can increase significantly in one summer. And if we have a relatively mild winter, which we didn't last year, or the rabbits have plenty of food and there's protection for them, as there often is in urban areas, they will feed on both of those situations are common in urban areas because people feed birds. Rabbits will come in and feed underneath the feeders as well. And they'll have, we put out these things we call decks, 4, 5, 6 inches off the ground, and it's wonderful protection for rabbits. So, we've provided for them food and cover pretty readily. So
even with predators making a bit of a comeback in Iowa, there aren't that many, except for maybe house cats.
Right. Yeah, and that's the other thing that's changed is we've changed the predation in cities to by having leash laws and encouraging people to keep their cats indoors. Quite honestly, more baby bunnies survive. And that's why very often in urban areas we see tremendous fluctuations and what appear to be, at least on a local basis, increases in the population because lack of predators and abundant food supply.
But the population still goes up and down. I
mean, sure.
It's not like Mark is going to always see more and more and more bunnies in his yard.
No. It'll certainly it decreases every year. It's one of the reasons that species have lots of young is so that a few will maybe survive. Humans used to do the same thing. We used to have very, very large families. Now we don't do that. Other species react the same way. They have large families so that maybe another pair or two will survive to reproduce and keep the species going. Rabbits are one of those that is prime food for lots and lots of predators, both from the air and on the ground. And so they have to have large litters in order to have just a few that survive. You add to that winter weather, severe winter weather, storms, floods, those sorts of things, and you can see how the population can go up and down quite rapidly.
Right. Mark, thank you for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, I want to talk about fire now. I mean, you mentioned fire, and of course, There was a much larger landscape of grassland. So when the Native Americans set fires, then the animals could move.
Right. Yeah.
Now, and of course, with the prairies that we have, fires are really useful management tool. Are we causing problems for the populations that we've created habitat for by burning prairies every year?
The short answer is quite likely yes. Fire is a very important management tool. We use it, we being wildlife managers, use it a lot, particularly to reestablish native species of grasses and forbs in the prairie landscape. And it's a very important reason we do that, because the North American prairie evolved with fire. Native Americans made extensive use of fire for a variety of purposes. One of them was to attract buffalo herds close to their villages or in an area, because when you burn an area, fresh grasses come up and the prairie is stimulated by the fire and new plants come up, and grazing animals like bison and elk were attracted to that. Much easier to hunt them. If they're the basis of your whole economy, you use what you have available. So fire was used extensively. Prairies are evolved in the presence of fire. When 85% of Iowa was prairie, everything from dry prairie to mesic prairie to wet prairie, about 85% of the state was prairie, and they burned, it was no big deal because other animals, even though they might burn a whole corner of the state or something, if the fire got away or it was extremely dry, animals could not only go to other areas of prairie, but they're often with large burns, they're often refugia, places within that prairie that don't get burned. And so they had places to go. Now, with so few small remnants available, burning can create a real problem. There's been a lot of research, for example, in insects and invertebrates on the prairie, that after a burn, their populations appear to recover only after 4 or 5 years. They do recover, but it takes that long. So if we're burning that prairie every year, that can present a real problem, certainly for invertebrate populations. Maybe we ought to think about patch burning portions of it. And that's what very knowledgeable managers are now doing. They're burning it more in a checkerboard pattern, and they're not burning every year. In fact, some of them are not even burning every 3 or 4 years. They're waiting 4, 5, even 6 years between burns. And that may cause us to think about, the emerging research has caused us to think about overuse of fire. What other kinds of tools do we have in our toolbox, something beyond a fire on our prairies?
Well, and previously on the show, we've talked about evidence that you've seen and that others have seen that maybe spring burning isn't necessarily the right way to go either.
Right, yeah. Maybe we're burning at the wrong time of year. If you think about it, it's a lot drier in the fall. Now, it doesn't leave a lot of overwintering habitat,
right, then,
and so there are problems. It's a careful, the more we learn, the more we know we don't know, and we need to find out additional things.
Now, of course, prairie managers are not the only people who use fire. I mean, if you live in the countryside in Iowa, you see a lot of people using fire. A lot of people burn their ditches. A
right.
lot of people burn their brush piles.
Right.
Is that creating a problem?
Well, when you're looking at limited habitat availability, which certainly in the Iowa landscape we now have that, especially in the last 18 months, and we talked about this about a year ago, I think, on this program, we talked about the incredible amount of destruction of the little places that used to be very abundant, those little abandoned farmsteads, the fence rows, this one little grove of trees. In the last couple of years, those have been taken down at rates I've never seen before in my lifetime here in the state, to get in, one or two more rows of corn. And that's all been driven by the commodity market and the desire to have one more a row of corn or two rows of corn. And that's a shame, I think, because now it means that those little places, those brush piles, those ditches. That's the habitat that's left on very much of the landscape. And if we burn those every year, if we don't leave some of those brush piles, if we don't leave some of these messy fence rows that an awful lot of species need, we're going to have real problems with a number of wildlife species on the Iowa landscape.
Let's talk about animals that are managed by humans, because we've talked about population dynamics and how, of course, the populations go up and down naturally. There are some animals, particularly game animals, mm-hmm. that humans want to have a steady population of.
Right. Yeah. And okay, we talked about different kinds of mortality, different kinds of death. It could be caused by predators. It could be caused storms, by climate. Young birds get, we've probably seen a lot of this spring, young birds have succumbed to exposure when we have rain day after day after day, as we did for a couple of weeks there.
They just can't keep warm.
No, they can't keep warm. And mom tries as best she can, but she can't do it all the time, and they die of exposure. And I think we saw an awful lot of that this spring. And if the weather pattern continues, even if they renest, we may see some more of that. But the what was the question again?
We're talking about the difference between a population of animals that's managed by humans to those natural ups and downs.
Right. And the other thing we haven't talked about is disease, and disease is a natural phenomenon as well. So you add all those things together, and in a given year, a certain percentage of the population is not going to survive. In many cases, it might be as much as 80% of a population of vertebrate species, be they birds or mammals, is not going to survive to the following spring when they can. So under natural conditions, without human management at all, 80% isn't going to survive. So what we've done in modern game management is looked at, okay, if 80% is not going to survive, what happens if we harvest, if we take for our consumption, if we take off, if we take 20%, does that mean that the other 80% is still going to die? Or does that mean that only 60% more will die? And so you end up with that's called compensatory mortality. It compensates. So we can take a harvest off, be they rabbits, pheasants, deer, whatever, and some continue to die. Some others continue to die from disease or lack of food or predators, whatever, weather events. But overall, the population stays about the same from year to year. And that's called compensatory mortality. And in modern game management, that's what you strive for, is to balance the take. And that's why we have things like bag limits, the number you can take per day, or possession limits, the number you can have in your possession. That's why we have licensing. Before we had all those things and they were effectively enforced, people took what they wanted, when they wanted, whatever they wanted, and populations really, really suffered.
Right. We've told that story over and over again on this show, how populations had almost disappeared of certain species.
Yeah, well,
in
some species they did. It's just amazing. So,
but you mentioned disease as, of course, something that causes population decline. When we're trying to protect a population to keep it at a certain level so we can harvest as many as we want every year, do we create an environment that is open or more open to diseases? And I'm thinking, of course, about chronic wasting disease in deer and some of the other things that we see.
Yeah, chronic wasting disease may not be the best example, but certainly when you have very dense populations, and a lot of people who feed birds have seen this in their birds, for example, when there's a disease of the eye in house finches where they get these encrusted eyes, and I think a lot of bird feeders have seen that in some of their house finches. Whenever you concentrate birds in an area, concentrate any species, and you have high numbers in an area, the chance of a disease spreading from individual to individual increases. And chronic wasting disease certainly at higher densities of deer, it may be symptomatic of high densities, but it's also increasingly found in not such high densities. So because those prions, and we did a show about this a while back too, survive, in the soil. And so it may not have to do as much with densities of species. But it certainly diseases when you have high populations, there's a chance of a greater chance of it spreading in a population if it is spread by contact, for example.
Of course, we also have a situation where a lot of people, and I'll continue to pick on the white-tailed deer, but
sure,
then a lot of people complain about overpopulation of white-tailed deer, which, of course, is a population that we spent many years nurturing.
Yeah, nurturing, trying to get it to come back. 120 years ago now, there were no deer left in Iowa, effectively. And so the storms and fires that we've talked about are one way of that they certainly impact populations, but humans impact them probably today more than an individual storm event ever could.
The changing environment that we all are struggling with somewhat, we seem to be having more severe storms,
right,
and these extremes from last year, the drought to the wettest spring on record, that has to be affecting wildlife populations as well.
Oh, yeah, it does. And when we get really concerned is certainly, especially when we have two conditions, one, a very rare species, or secondly, a very rare habitat. If those get, if a single event, a single storm event, maybe it's a tornado, maybe it's a flood, can destroy that habitat, then there are a lot of species that are dependent on that habitat that are really in trouble. Same thing is true if you've got very rare species. A single event, you look at, there are a number of extremely rare species on the island of birds on the island of Hawaii. And if West Nile virus, for example, travels with a mosquito on an airplane to Hawaii, there are a whole bunch of species that could be impacted very, very, and it may wipe them out. So, when you get those two conditions, single events can, and that we have that increasingly today, single events, be they storms or fires or disease, can severely impact a population.
So in a spring like this one, Jim, where, of course, a lot of us were worried about our homes and our communities, but a lot of us were also thinking about the wild creatures, what should we be thinking about as we watch nature take its course?
Yeah, I think the solution is providing as much habitat as we possibly can, be it socially acceptable and economically feasible, providing as much habitat in as broad an area, not just on the lowlands along our rivers, not just in prairies, but taking the variety of habitats, and the most we can provide, that's the best we can hope for. And nature's going to do the rest on its own. It will respond. The species will respond to the habitat that we've made available. And I think that if we continue that, they'll survive the kinds of changes we bring to the landscape, or many species will anyway, as long as we provide enough habitat and a variety of places for it to be.
Well, and maybe creating habitat will become more socially acceptable.
I hope so.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is also an environmental interpretive and wildlife consultant based in Ames. By the way, we mentioned orphaned wild creatures earlier this hour. If you go to our Facebook page, you can see a picture of orphaned fawns raised by my licensed wildlife rehabilitator mother last year. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. This is Talk of Iowa.